Released 16 years after the original, this sequel feels like too little too late, or too much too late. It's hard to tell here, because it's kind of both. One thing is for sure, this sequel does not live up to the original. It not only doesn't live up to it, it's also the worst sequel possible. Well, almost. Let's take a look at it all. For starters, the story is both lazy and a mess. It starts with three American tourists traveling through Europe thrill-seeking, and they are about to get what they came for. One evening in Paris, they decide to break into the Eiffel Tower to bungee jump from it. There, they meet a young woman looking like she's about to jump off the tower without a bungee or any safety items. Our hero Andy saves her, and a connection is made. Soon after, Andy gets bitten, and Seraphine has to explain to him his new life. Through a lot of twists and turns, most of them either nonsensical or uninteresting, we get to meet a gang of werewolves hosting parties for victims, a stepfather who searched for a cure, a tenuous connection to the first one, and ultimately, the last third that is just so 1990s, it almost hurts. So what happened here? Let's find out in What the F*** Happened to This Horror Movie. Well, lots of things, and nothing, and everything in between. The film was developed as a sequel to An American Werewolf in London, but without the rights to the characters from the original, so they could not directly mention any of them. The ideas are all there though. The werewolf bit happening to an American tourist in a European city, a love story, some transformations, the ghost of friends and victims haunting our lead, some gore, some blood, some humor, and a sex scene. The film follows some of the beats of the original, and it does bring a few new ideas to the table, but is it enough? The answer is easy, absolutely not. The film may hit some of the same beats and have a lot in common with the original, but it pales in comparison, that is for sure. The film here has a story that is not great, but not the worst. It's basically a boy meets girl, boy saves girl, boy gets bitten by a werewolf, then discovers his girlfriend is a werewolf as well. Then they team up to fight the bad werewolves and to find a cure for themselves. The ideas themselves aren't all bad, there is a lot of potential here, and that is a big part of why this film is so frustrating to watch. It had so much potential, but the potential is completely squandered on all fronts. There was a way here to make something great, to expand on the universe of the first one, but this film took the lazy route, and fans saw right through it as soon as it was released. The reviews for it now show as a 7% on Rotten Tomatoes, and anyone who has seen the film can probably tell why. The public's rating is a bit nicer, with a 30% audience score. So, while the story is not the worst, it's pretty bad. It is, however, not the worst part of this film. Where the film loses the most points here is with the special effects. The original had some of the best practical effects available at the time, bringing the transformation scene to life in a way that was absolutely phenomenal at the time. Even to today's standards, these effects are impressively stunning. Rick Baker's team did some exceptional work in An American Werewolf in London, winning Baker the Oscar for Best Makeup. The sequel, however, did not win an Oscar, and a quick watch of the beasts in this movie makes it very clear as to why. The werewolf transformations here are all CGI, and goodness, that CGI is terrible. Even in 1997, it was a bit suspect, and over 2.5 decades later, it's just atrocious. Thankfully, not all of the special features are CGI, and some of them were practical effects, including, but not limited to, those on actress Julie Bowen, post-werewolf encounter. Her attack leads to the canonical haunting by a victim of our lead. Her makeup design is a nod to that done on Griffin Dunne as Jack in the original film, with some slight differences to update it a bit. The gag where she tries to whistle is good and well done in terms of effects. It helped the film as a whole in terms of gore and blood not feel like a total waste. This little bit of good helps save the film, really. Now let's take a peek at the cast. In the lead role is Tom Everett Scott. The actor has since admitted that he was very excited about making this film as it would allow him to do things others do not get to do, like climbing the Eiffel Tower at night. Also, this was his first trip outside of the United States at the tender age of 26 years old, so perhaps the look was more one of fascination with the locations he kept finding himself in. Julie Delphi plays his love interest here, Seraphine, and she has since admitted that she did the film so she could pay her rent. A noble endeavor, to be honest, as everyone needs to work to keep a roof over their heads. Here, this is one of her worst films, but she does not give a fully terrible performance. She's not at her best, but she also is clearly trying to be something to her character and make Seraphine something more than just the cute cute girl who leads the American astray. Playing one of the victims is Julie Bowen, who has a good sense of comedic timing normally, but here, something comes off clunky in her delivery. Her work is not the worst of the bunch, but something is definitely off, like perhaps she was directed in the wrong way or given the wrong lines. She does get a few funny moments, including the aforementioned moment as a ghoulish ghost, where she attempts to whistle. However, this should not have been a main meaty scene for her, but it is. Her earlier scenes range from horrendous to passable, with the flirty back and forth in the restaurant with Tom Everett Scott being the worst of it. That scene alone tells a lot as to why this film fails on so many levels, but before we get to this, let's talk about the rest of the cast. Thierry Lhermitte shows up, and well, he is so underused, they might as well have used a mannequin, and no one would have noticed a difference. Why even hire him? Why underuse him? Well, to be able to say you have Monsieur Lhermitte in your cast, that is. The rest of the cast is filled with people either hired to be victims, werewolves, or annoying. Yep, that's it. Annoying. Most of them give performances that are interchangeable at best, and just so bland, they are immediately forgotten in most cases. The tenuous connection to the original makes absolutely no sense. If you look at the years that these came out and the ages of the characters, it may not have been 100% their fault. It may have been imposed by the studio, especially considering the film had been in development for 6 years, and even at one point had a script by John Landis, which is something that could make for an interesting read for sure. As it stands, the film has a script with a hand from the director, Waller, in it, and if that is indicative of anything, it means the film is mostly his and so shall be the blame. Well, kind of, because a lot of it should also come down on the producers, the studio, and anyone who had any input in the film. The story here is not the worst, as we've said, but it's not exactly great, and it doesn't offer much interest in terms of what is new. The characters are mostly annoying people or folks no one would want to have anything to do with. The humor is crass at times, and juvenile at others, while attempting to mimic the original in tone and failing royally. The direction here is just hard to describe. It feels both not there at times and far too involved in others. Some of the artistic choices made here are just not right for the film. At this point, one would think there's pretty much nothing to save this film except for the one little bit of good practical effects, which is overshadowed by the abysmal CGI. Well, that is another case of yes and no. The film itself is not great. It's cheesy and it has a ton of issues, but anyone who was alive and listening to music back then would say that the film's soundtrack is something that shines. Of course, this will depend on taste and preferred musical styles, but the soundtrack overall is pretty excellent in terms of 1997 hit rock songs. Well, okay, not all of it. While the Bush song Mouth is catchy and has audio deliciousness, the soundtrack has a few odd choices. Bush, Cake, Fastball, and Skinny Puppy were all solid choices in 1997, and even now, really, but other songs were much less correct, including Walking on the Sun by Smash Mouth. Like, what? No. No thank you. Even back then, that was an odd choice. One that now feels more Shrek than Werewolf. Beyond the problems with the script, direction, production, performance, special effects, and some of the soundtrack, there's no way a sequel to An American Werewolf in London would fail at the box office now, would it? Well, yeah, it did. It is considered a flop, and a flop it was. The film cost around $25 million and made about $26.6 million at the domestic box office, which covered the production costs, but not much else in terms of marketing and publicity, which the film has plenty of. The film was released on December 25, 1997, something of a tradition back in the day when a horror film always got released right around Christmas. It's something to cut through the horror of the holidays for some. Here, the film was released on the biggest counter holiday for horror, and it flopped, as we had previously mentioned. The film was released the very same day as Jackie Brown's wide release and against recent releases, including the unbeatable box office hit Titanic, Amistad, As Good As It Gets, and The Postman. The competition was fierce, and it didn't help An American Werewolf in Paris one bit. Had it been released with nothing against it, or only against Mr. Magoo, it would have had a chance. Against Jackie Brown? No chance of being number one. The film ended up in fourth place on opening day, behind those films, and as well as Good As It Gets, which is no small feat. However, the film did not have much staying power and had diminishing returns, as it was already out of the top seven the next day. Those who were around back then probably remember seeing the film in magazines, the trailer on television, and posters in bus stops and public transport stations. The music video for the lead single by Bush was everywhere, and the song played a bunch on the radio. So clearly a lot of money was most likely spent on marketing. As these expenses are often not counted in film budgets, the total spending was most likely quite a bit higher than the box office. Of course, there was some money made once the film hit home video, but the film had already gathered a bad reputation as a terrible movie. So rentals were, well, low too. At this point, the film seems to be finding its audience still with a Blu-ray release and folks enjoying it as one of those so bad it's good films. In terms of that, it's definitely a success. It sucks, but man, is it fun to watch. At this point in time, the film has found an audience that loved it for all that was wrong with it, something that was probably not even on the horizon when it was released and initially flopped. Fans of the original hated the sequel and were quite clear about it, even in the early days of the internet. The film was not well received at all and it didn't do well clearly. However, now it's a fun window into what can and does go wrong in a sequel, what can be done to correct them, and what should be avoided at all costs. Of course, there is no fixing this film this far down the line, but there is a way to enjoy it, watching it with a group of friends, some beverages of choice, and roasting the whole thing as it plays. It's the perfect film for bad movie night.